This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. Recently, we had on the air Jim Ventura, who represents Maya Energy LLC, the organization that is planning a proposed materials resource facility in Gary. Well, today we have in studio talking the other side of the story. Hoosier Environmental Council attorney Sam Henderson will be with us to talk more about the project and the people concerned about the project, their impact, and what's going to happen in that. We'll no doubt get an update. Also today on the program, it's another edition of Green Fleet Radio with your host, Carl Lissick. And a little later in the program, we'll have Tom Maloney's interview with Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson. She's getting ready to join a delegation headed on a trade mission in Canada. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We had not long ago a representative from Maya Energy LLC, which is the company that is planning a proposed materials resource recovery facility in Gary, and we'll talk about the project in detail. There have been a number of people, including the folks who run and the occupants, students, if you wish to call them that, of a private charter school, which is across the highway from this proposed facility that is being built. And the residents in the neighborhood, although there aren't many, are very concerned. And most of those residents are other commercial businesses. They are also concerned about the issues of being along West 35th Avenue. And in addition, the Hoosier Environmental Council has joined in helping out the residents and trying to get the question brought up before state environmental regulators about the feasibility of the project, or maybe you should say the suitability of the project might be a better way to put it. We have Sam Henderson. He's an attorney for the Hoosier Environmental Council with us, representing, he is in the office that represents Northwest Indiana. Sam, thank you very much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, first tell us a little bit more. I guess we've got some great detail about the project itself from Maya Energy LLC. They've told us specifically what they would like to do on the site, what they would if they got all of the environmental permits that they need from the state to do so. What is, first off, what is the official Hoosier Environmental Council concerns about this particular site in Gary to be used for this particular use?
We have a number of concerns, but the biggest underlying concern is that this is not an appropriate location for this facility, especially with one of the increasingly few schools in Gary located right across the street, and also that it's really unclear that this is an appropriate facility anywhere, in the sense that it doesn't really appear to be fulfilling an existing need for solid waste, and that creates a lot of problems with the sustainability of a project, because a lot of times when you have a solid waste facility that isn't commercially viable or isn't fulfilling a definite need in the system, that creates an opportunity for a lot of things to go wrong.
I like to take the opportunity here while we have a chance to talk in a little more detail about the concerns, especially from what the HEC has seen. Tell us first off here, what is the procedure now? This is going before the staff members at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management.
That's right.
And even Mr. Ventura mentioned in detail about the fact that they have a pre-operating permit, or at least a permit to be able to build something initially or get things started first. That's the first procedure that they are going through and with the state, and they've gone through that now. But now they're going through the actual operating permit process. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I guess perhaps I don't see the process in quite the way that Mr. Ventura does. Uh-huh. They have received an air permit that allows them from the standpoint of the air quality regulations that allow them to construct their facility. But they are not allowed to construct a solid waste processing facility until they have received this permit that they are seeking now, which is the solid waste permit. And as you said, that is currently gone to the state regulators, to the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. And at this point, the public comment period is closed, so we are waiting to see what they think.
Well, that period closed about a week ago, I guess, or pretty close to it.
Yeah,
not very long.
March 12th. Yeah.
Tell us, if you will, what kind of a case you've made before the Indiana Department of Environmental Management about this particular project, and please give us an idea in particular what are the concerns, not only of the Hoosier Environmental Council, but as well as the residents and Steel City Academy, which is the school we're talking about right across the street from this project.
Yeah. Well, we were very pleased and glad to be able to present a joint comment that was not only from the Hoosier Environmental Council, but from many local residents and local business owners, local religious leaders, and above all, the faculty and staff of the Steel City Academy. So we have presented a united front, and we've raised quite a few issues. Some of the key ones are that they haven't met some of the formal requirements, such as demonstrating an Indiana solid waste need for this facility, or showing that they have either ownership or a leasehold on the property where they want to build. Both of those are explicitly required under state law, mm-hmm. and in our view, they have not met those requirements. And underlying that, of course, are the deeper concerns that this is not an appropriate facility, and it may not be operated in accordance with the law. And so that's why those formal defects are especially concerning, and why we believe that IDEM should reject the permit.
Let's take up the question first here about the ownership or lease, at least on and how this is supposed to be set up here officially, based on what the state environmental rules are for whoever owns the property or has control of the property for any project like this. Tell us about this particular site and the concerns there.
Okay, so this site was taken over by the state from a private owner in 1979, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it was deeded by the state to the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission in 1981 when the commission was set up.
Now, that was through for the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, right?
That's right. Okay. Yeah.
And it's turned over now to the Little Calumet River Basin Redevelopment Commission, the full title. Mm-hmm. And what is this site? I guess we know what kind of it's along 35th Avenue, but mm-hmm. what is this site so close to the river and why? And it's understandable why the DNR turned it over to the commission for safekeeping, I suppose, or operation, or for at least for use in the future.
It was turned over as part of the Little Calumet Commission holds a lot of the land all along the river, and this is part of that. Part of the lot is inside the levee. Part of it is outside the levee. Where they want to build is just outside the levee, or I should say, away from the river.
Yeah, right along 35th Avenue. Yeah, yeah, right directly off the street.
And it's currently used for low impact farming. I think at the moment there are soybeans on it.
Mm-hmm.
And some trees. It's just sort of your basic farm field, and it's been in that shape essentially for at least 30 years.
One of the other concerns that you mentioned here is there whether there is truly a need for this particular type of facility to handle this type of solid waste, or at least solid waste in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're the kind of facility that's been applied for here, which is to create a refuse-derived fuel, is the kind of facility that was very popular in the 1980s when there was a perceived need for substitutes for coal, for things you can burn instead of coal in a power plant or a steel mill. And, the world has kind of moved on from that. We're not burning coal.
Isn't that in a way very similar to the original plans for even the city of Indianapolis to have mm-hmm. their facility, their incinerator built in downtown Indianapolis, was to take in all this trash, basically, to come in and be able to create steam out of it. And that's the steam that was going to be pumped through the downtown Indianapolis buildings.
Yeah. And in fact, the Covanta facility in Indianapolis is currently the only waste energy facility of this kind anywhere in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. If I guess the concern comes up here is not only whether this is the proper use for the land, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Since you all are familiar with the solid waste needs and disposal needs of the state of Indiana and in Northwest Indiana in particular, what type of facilities does the Hoosier Environmental Council support or endorse, maybe, to be able to deal with some of the issues of the waste that comes into Northwest Indiana and the uses to find homes for recyclables or, mm-hmm. I guess, in another sense, too, homes for construction demolition waste that we know that would certainly come from the city of Gary. They've proposed a similar site of sorts to handle the material the contractors can bring in from tearing down all the dilapidated buildings in Gary.
Mm-hmm. We're certainly very much in favor of recycling and in favor of reuse. We're very excited about some of the work that's been done, for example, by the Delta Institute in terms of repurposing demolition materials.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't want to stand in the way of that. However, there's a real concern whenever you're dealing with essentially an unrestricted general waste flow that you're going to end up dealing with things that are not safe and ending up with the kind of side effects that we've unfortunately seen around Gary and East Chicago many times over. So there's kind of a high threshold of persuasion there.
I know that that My Energy LLC, in having to turn in their application for this solid waste facility permit with IDEM, they have to state in many terms how they're going to deal with such things as pests, vectors, as it's called, I guess, in the commercial world, as well as dealing with not only smells, but also with the potential for hazardous waste that could come in and how that's going to be handled if the facility were built. How does the HEC stand on some of these things that are brought forth in the permit application?
Well, we're very concerned about the lack of experience in the team that is actually standing behind this project. I mean, anyone can write a persuasive explanation of how you're going to handle all of these issues, whether it's smell or it's rodents or anything else. But actually running a facility that handles, in this case, 2,400 tons of solid waste a day is something that requires a significant amount of expertise. And when it's handled by people who don't have that expertise, again, the risks of something going wrong become much higher.
I know that you don't directly represent the folks at Steel City right. Academy, but you're working very closely with the owners, the principal at the school, mm-hmm. as well as, I guess, in a way, the students. They're very, very vocal about this. They're a very, very activistic stand up right now, I understand.
Yeah, it has been really impressive to see what the students at Steel City Academy are doing.
They've had an opportunity, I guess, to send a response of their own, haven't they, mm-hmm. down to Indianapolis during the public comment period?
Yes. On March 12th, the principal and some students hand-delivered, I believe, approximately 500 public comments, mm-hmm. largely handwritten, to IDEM.
Now, you mentioned the public comment period has ended, and it's now up to IDEM, and I guess more the staffers in particular. Tell us how that's handled from that point on, and how they kind of go through the decision making process on their end that you're familiar with.
Well, I think anytime you have a high profile project like this, there's going to be a lot of involvement from several levels. There's a permit manager who handles, the basic mechanics, and then there's a section chief, and there are deputy commissioners, and there's ultimately Commissioner Bruno Piggott, who is running the show.
Right.
And I expect at some level all of those people will be involved in examining these comments and deciding what their ultimate decision is going to be.
Now, what typically kind of timetable do they usually have when they get an average permit, so to speak, that comes in the door there in Indianapolis and gets sorted out there at IDEM before some decisions made and some permit comes back to the who applied for it?
I think under normal circumstances, it might be 1 or 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation, my understanding is that the IDEM staff are actually required to read and respond to each public comment they've received. And since they have received several hundred, that may slow the process down somewhat.
And I'm sure that the bureaucrats in Indianapolis at the state office building aren't happy with that, but that's part of the job. It comes with the territory, I understand. So what does the Hoosier Environmental Council, are they able to do at this point now that the public comment period is over? Is it just in case you're watching this very closely, or is there any more that you can do from the organization standpoint?
Well, we're continuing to talk to people in the community. We're talking to local government and other people who may have some influence on the process or different aspects of the process. The Little Calumet Commission still has some say in how this shapes out because this is their land. The city of Gary may still have something to say about this process. But as far as the state permit, we're primarily in a wait and see situation.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of first off here of the city of Gary, since we know and we've mentioned before, and even we brought up in that conversation with Mr. Ventura that the city of Gary is trying to deal with their own construction mm-hmm. demolition waste problems. As we said, they have many buildings they wish to have demolished, but they have no place to stage the material the contractors would bring over from a group of houses in some neighborhood, be it Glen Park or any place for that matter in Gary, and then for that material to be properly disposed of, is there anything that there's much can be done right now, or is it still a wait and see situation for the city of Gary about this?
Well, I'm not really privy to their decision making.
Right.
It is my understanding from the mayor that they do not wish to use the Maya Energy facility. There's certainly a problem there, but I think where things get sticky is that these situations that are proposed, whether it's the landfill that was proposed under HB 1318 or this Maya Energy facility, yes, we have a problem with waste from Gary, but each of these facilities would be primarily handling waste that's not from Gary.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we're really going to look for solutions to Gary-specific waste problems, we've got to look for something that is narrowly tailored to what Gary needs.
And finally, Sam, what can we tell the folks at Steel City Academy and the neighbors that own businesses along that area?
Well, I would say everyone has done a great job, and we're going to keep fighting.
Sam Anderson is an attorney, represents the Hoosier Environmental Council. He works here in Northwest Indiana with the staff up here and stays in touch with the main office in Indianapolis. Sam, thank you for coming in, talking about this stance of the project.
Thank you very much.
We'll probably stay in touch as we will keep track of what's happening with Maya Energy LLC as well, too. But we hope to have you back to explain more problems that come up that involve the HEC.
I hope so.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time now for this edition of Green Fleet Radio, and here is your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. Terry Butler. He's the Director of Transportation for the School City of Hammond. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Terry, I just want to say congratulations being named the South Shore Clean Cities 2017 NERPC Green Fleet Member of the Year at our annual awards meeting in last month. So congratulations to you and the city.
I appreciate that. It came as a surprise because there's so many other groups that are much larger than us that are also doing an excellent job.
Well, and again, I think we've worked with you and many others from the School City of Hammond on numerous things, and it's a lot of little things, Terry. And I think that's the thing that we like to say is that working with you, it's been a wonderful experience. So I know the School City of Hammond has a large transportation system. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how students about the students in your department services?
Sure, we've got Hammond has over 13,000 students. We transport about 4,000 general ed students and another 650 special needs students, which is our biggest time issue is the special needs students.
I see. And so can you talk a little bit about some of the things that you had done to earn the NERPC Green Fleet Member of the Year Award?
Well, the big project that we did recently was to install preheaters on the buses through the help of South Shore Clean Cities so that we can, instead of using fuel in a bus running for an hour to try to warm up,
mm-hmm.
they can use the preheaters so when the drivers come in, it's already been heated up. It doesn't run the engine, but it uses about an eighth of a gallon of fuel per hour rather than 2 gallons an hour. And that the side benefits are it also heats up the interior of the bus somewhat.
Sure, sure. So how have the SBAR heaters helped School City of Hammond reduce emissions and save fuel and save money?
Well, as I said, it uses an eighth of a gallon mm-hmm. for the idling issues. The students get on the bus and the bus is already preheated. The drivers come in. They actually can come in 10 minutes later than they used to come in, so it saves a labor cost. But the windows are actually defrosting when they come in, so we don't lose that time. It's much safer.
Sure. So I hear you're saving on energy costs by using the heaters as well. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was something that we hadn't even thought about. Normally, these are diesel engines. We plug them in with a block heater so that they'll start the next day. With the SBAR heaters, because they do preheat the engine, we don't have to plug them in anymore. And that's roughly 70 to 80 buses that are drawing 13 amps per hour
mm-hmm.
Savings. So, and that was around the clock. They'd start as soon as they came in the afternoon. They'd be plugged in until they go out the next morning. So it's been a tremendous savings on electricity.
So in addition to the heaters, you've also changed some routes to help reduce idling and emissions.
We have. We've got a electronic routing program that takes out all the unnecessary expenses of buses going places they don't need to. It sets the routes up so they're the most efficient. We do one thing in Hammond. We insist on right-hand pickup so that kids aren't crossing streets. So that does change it a little bit, but the program does it. We have many, many changes daily with special needs. We average about 25 changes to the routes a day because of adjusted schedules and moving and such. So the routing program takes care of that. We don't have to sit and idle for long periods of time, so it's really helped as far as.
So what would you say to another school district that might be considering implementing an idle reduction program?
Well, not only is it good for the environment, it's good for the students too. A bus sitting and idling, it's still polluting. It still has some, even though the engines are much cleaner now than they were years ago, there's still a certain risk that you're taking. It saves fuel, cleans the air, keeps everybody happy.
Sure. And so then how can people learn more about some of the things that School City is doing with your different programs and things?
They're free to call me at any time. I'm listed on the school website, School City of Hammond. I can give them any information that we have done. I would mention, too, in the past, a number of years ago, a previous director was involved with using the what they called at the time, the bean oil fuel.
Sure.
And so we did do that, which made a difference, low sulfur fuel. I've been there for 27 years, and years ago there would be a haze when the buses all started up in the morning, and if you walked in it, your eyes burned. We don't have those issues anymore.
That's wonderful. And so what are some of the future plans for the School City of Hammond with your transportation services?
Well, depending on funding, because we're property tax-based, I personally and a large group of the people in the School City would like to start moving to alternative fuel, propane. We understand that it's doing very well. One of our neighboring districts was able to do some, and it has worked out very well for them. So that would probably be the next thing, is looking at the propane.
Wonderful. And I know, as we've talked before on this program, with the Volkswagen mitigation plan, that our state is going to be getting over $41 million of money for diesel emission reductions. And being in non-attainment areas here in Lake and Porter County, you know, working with you and other school corporations on really trying to take advantage of some of this money to assist some of our school corporations to reduce what is called NOx emissions. You know, we're hopefully going to be doing that. So it's an exciting time for all of us to help with that plan. So, you know, Terry, I know you're involved with a lot of different organizations with school transportation. Tell our listeners a little bit about some of the other groups that, you know, you with school transportation that you work on in our state.
Well, I have a seat on the, in fact, I have to go tomorrow, but I have a seat on the IDOE School Transportation Board that makes decisions on equipment on buses and modifications to buses. I'm involved with a committee trying to, as you said, the Volkswagen mitigation money, a statewide group there that we're trying to make sure that the voice of the school industry is heard. So those are the two big ones, other than the fact that I also sit on a school board at another district.
Sure. And again, I know that you've been very philanthropic in majority of your whole career. I know you've been involved with a lot of different things. And again, you know, I just want to say congratulations on all the great things that you do for the School City, but also here for our state. And, you know, again, thank you. And any closing thoughts?
Keep helping us as well as you do, because we all need it. And as I said, schools are taxed right now because of the property taxes, and that's our funding other than students. The students are funded by the general fund, which comes from the state, but everything else comes from property tax.
Well, and it's all about working together, and that's one of the things that we're proud of, working with wonderful folks like yourself, Terry. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Terry Butler, Director of Transportation for the School City of Hammond. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you.
And you can hear a podcast of Green Fleet Radio here on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And Green Fleet Radio is supported by South Shore Clean Cities. When the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issues a report on the number of overdoses in the United States, it's only as good as the data that states send in. This year, the CDC reported that overdoses from opioids, such as with prescription painkillers or heroin, jumped nearly 30% in 2016. More than 42,000 people died. But those are just the deaths that the CDC can definitively say were opioid-related. Jake Harper of Side Effects Public Media reports that the real number could be much higher.
So we are going back to what we call our receiving area.
Alfie Ballou is deputy coroner for Marion County, Indiana, and she oversees death investigations. When someone dies, an investigator from Ballou's office looks for clues.
We're going to look in that whole area where they were found. We're going to look in cabinets to look for syringes or other drug paraphernalia such as pipes, rolled up dollar bills, straws.
Items that could point to drug overdose as a possible cause of death. But to really know for sure that someone died of an overdose, investigators need to test bodily fluids. Ballou shows me inside a walk-in refrigerator where they store samples from people who have died. Blood and urine and the fluid inside the eye, known as vitreous.
We send that off to a toxicology lab to be tested for what we call drugs of abuse. Some prescribed drugs, definitely opioids, illicit drugs, cocaine, heroin, meth.
When all that information is in, the coroner fills out a death certificate. And if it's an overdose, they'll put that as the cause. But death investigators around the country don't always list the specific drugs involved. And that really matters. Christopher Room is a professor at University of Virginia, and he's published two papers on this topic recently.
In some cases, they're classifying it as a drug death, but they don't list the kind of drug that was involved.
If you don't specify that an opioid or cocaine or meth contributed to someone's death, that information isn't captured by the state or the CDC. And because of that, we are undercounting opioid-related overdoses across the U.S. Room says that big number from the CDC, 42,000 opioid-related overdose deaths, that number should be nearly 50,000. Indiana's count is especially off. Room estimates that the state's opioid overdose rate was actually twice as high as what the CDC reported in 2014.
There are other states that do very well. I mean, there are some states that have pretty much 100% reporting.
He says a major factor is who investigates deaths. In some states, like Indiana, every county has a coroner. Coroners are usually elected. They may not be medical professionals or trained to put specific information on death certificates. Other states have medical examiners, who are doctors. In some cases, there's a chief medical examiner for the whole state.
States that have centralized oversight with medical examiners tend to do better than those with coroners.
Another problem is that death investigators don't always test bodily fluids. Brad Ray is a researcher at Indiana University's School of Public and Environmental Affairs. Why are some coroners doing this and not others?
The cost is kind of the main thing that I've heard anecdotally. But the other is they're not required to. Right. So if you're not required to pay for it and you're not required to report it, then why would you? So we need to change that.
Indiana lawmakers passed new rules this year to fix this. Starting in July, coroners will have to run tox screens for suspected overdoses and report the results to the state. And the state will help cover the added costs. More accurate data will likely make the opioid problem look worse as the numbers go up. But Ray says that could help the state access federal funds and keep better track of drug problems.
So we can see when trends are happening. We can see when there tends to be increases in cocaine and meth and decreases in opioids if that happens.
Alfie Ballou's team was already getting tox screens for suspected overdoses. But it wasn't until she went to a conference last year that she realized they need to include more information on death certificates. Now her team will list specific drugs.
So we'll say drug overdose or drug intoxication with... And then we identify the drugs. So if it's five drugs that have caused or contributed to the death, then we put those five drugs down.
Ballou plans to teach other coroners to do it the same way. Jake Harper, Side Effects Public Media.
Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson joined Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney yesterday afternoon to talk about her upcoming trade mission, a visit to Canada with Governor Eric Holcomb and the rest of the team. Mayor Freeman Wilson also talks about business expansion for the Hoosier State and... what's next for the city of Gary following the bid the city made for Amazon HQ2?
Mayor Freeman Wilson, what's the overall goal of the trip to Canada coming up on March 28th?
The overall goal of our mission, trade mission trip to Canada is really to meet with government officials, meet with local businesses. Gary, or the state of Indiana, has a trade surplus with Canada. There are a number of Canadian companies, specifically Canadian National Railroad is one of them, which with large operations in the state of Indiana. We actually host CN in our city. So we're going to talk to them about expansion opportunities for existing businesses here in the state of Indiana, but also new opportunities with new businesses who may have an interest in coming into the state of Indiana.
Mayor, are there other organizations like Canadian National that are coming in or out of Canada that are currently based in Gary?
There really isn't necessarily another company, but there are types of companies that we believe would be conducive to have operations in the state of Indiana. You know, Canada is a large steel producer. Obviously, so is the city of Gary with U.S. Steel. But also, there are finishers that would be a great match or fit for the city of Gary. Logistics companies would be an awesome match for the city of Gary. The important part for Indiana generally is that we're at the crossroads of America, but the most important aspect for Gary is that we're at the population center of North America. So if you look at Canada, Mexico, the United States, this is the population center of all of that.
President Trump is calling for 25% increases on tariffs for foreign-made steel. What kind of an impact is that going to have for the city of Gary?
Well, certainly, when you look at the tariffs as a benefit to the steel industry, U.S. Steel's flagship is in Gary, Indiana. That is a positive all day long. You know, so we are certainly optimistic about that aspect of the tariffs. We're also cautious about the fact that when you have tariffs on, it impacts other manufacturers. And so to the extent that manufacturers also get their goods, their steel goods from other manufacturers of steel outside of the country, then that could be a challenge, particularly those who get them from Canada or Mexico, even though we know that those two countries are exempt from the tariffs.
Gary fell short in its bid for Amazon HQ2. What have you seen as sort of the bounce back for the city of Gary? Is there anything coming to the Steel City as a result of its efforts to go ahead and land HQ2?
We've seen tremendous success. We've had success in conjunction with the Amazon bid from Chicago. Many people don't know that the Gary Airport was a part of Chicago's submission. So we thought we had a couple of bites at the apple, either through our own and certainly through Chicago's. So that's still alive and well. The other aspect, though, is because we were able to really highlight our logistics benefits, our logistics advantages, our trucks, our highways, the fact that we have an airport that is ripe for greater development and that we are on a waterway. All of those things are positives. And companies have reached out to us because it was something that they had never considered. I think that the fact that I'm on this trade mission, the only mayor on this trade mission with the governor, is a positive that resulted from the fact that he was impressed with our Amazon submission.
And Mayor Freeman Wilson, one last question. What are the plans for the city of Gary for the Buffington Harbor?
Buffington Harbor is an absolute jewel for us in that it can accommodate barge traffic. It can accommodate other opportunities. And because of the recent demolition of the Dean Mitchell Power Plant, it is certainly viable for us in Gary and in Northwest Indiana. I think that when the Ports of Indiana was talking about it not being viable, they were looking more at for the deep water solution, the deep water option. There are other options separate and apart from that. The other positive aspects, when we decided to activate the Port Commission, it wasn't about water. It was really about using the report as a development opportunity, as the state statute will allow us to do. So we believe that our port play is a very, very good economic development opportunity, and we're seeing that already come to pass as folks have looked at the potential to factor that into their location decision.
Thank you so much, Mayor Freeman Wilson, for updating us on the business aspects and growth for the Steel City. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Tom Maloney.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us. Tomorrow it's going to be Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we have, among others, we'll have Joseph Pete, who is the business reporter for The Times, as well as Times State House correspondent Dan Carton.